Good morning and greetings in Jesus' name to you. It's a privilege to worship with you on the Lord's Day. Something special about a day that blends a creation principle of rest with a New Testament principle of resurrection. It's the night of December 30, 1862, just outside Murfreesboro in central Tennessee. After a day of skirmishing, maneuvering, and preparing positions, 83,000 troops from the two great armies of the American Civil War are settling in for an uneasy night. Barely 2,000 feet separate the Federal and Confederate armies this cold, damp winter night. And every soldier on the field knows that as the sun goes down on the 30th, that when it rises the following day, he's going to be engaged in a death struggle. As the dread deepens, various military bands on both sides of the no man's land in both armies try to lift the mood by playing their favorite songs. And so soon a musical battle ensues between the Union bands and the Confederate bands, each trying to drown out the music coming from the other side. So the Confederates play the Bonnie Blue Flag, and the Federals answer with Hail Columbia, Yankee Doodle versus Dixie. But eventually those lively patriotic tunes die away as one brass band strikes up the haunting strains of Home Sweet Home. Mid pleasures and palaces, though we may roam, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. A charm from the skies seems to hallow us there, which seek through the world is ne'er met elsewhere. And the bands on both sides drop their north-south competition and join in this mournful song as thousands of troops from both armies sing the chorus together, home, home. Sweet, sweet home, there's no place like home. There's no place like home. Home is a word that arouses deep, fundamental human emotions tied to core human needs. Comfort, security, belonging, refuge. We associate the word home with family, with memories, with a sense of identity. It's part of our heritage. It represents the place we came from, and it has the roots that connect us to our past. The word home arouses such strong emotional responses that some Union armies in the Civil War reportedly banned the singing of Home Sweet Home out of fear that the emotions that it aroused would cause homesick soldiers to desert. The home, the family, is the bedrock of society, and it was part of God's perfect design from creation. If you care to, you may open your Bibles to a very fundamental verse in Genesis 2. It's a verse that we all are familiar with, could probably say it by memory, but in our day and age of confusion, I think it's a verse that we need to re-establish in our minds and anchor our homes to. Genesis 2, verse 24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Leaving and cleaving. And as soon as God had established this first home, according to his perfect design, Satan, as he always does when God engineers something perfect, Satan begins to attack it. And it wasn't long until in chapter 3, Adam and Eve fell into sin and they started to blame each other. Another few chapters, chapter 4, Cain slew his brother Abel. The end of chapter 4, Lamech, Adam's grandson, begins polygamy. And so Satan was on the march, attacking the home. And today, the home is certainly under attack. Certainly in society, it's under attack. I looked at some of the statistics. 21% of the children in the United States live in a single-parent home with no other adults in the picture. Roughly one-fourth of U.S. children live without a father in the home. Between 40 and 50% of U.S. marriages end in divorce. And frighteningly, between 20 and 25% of Christian marriages end in divorce. So is it any wonder that sincere Christians are increasingly alarmed to see a rising tide of confusion and misery and debauchery and atheism? And sometimes we go to Psalm 11, verse 3, and we lament, "If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do?" Well, that's a rhetorical question, because what can the righteous do? They can go back to the foundation and build anew on the foundation. Leo Tolstoy, in the opening sentence of one of his novels, Anna Karenina, said, "All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." And what he intended to say by that was that happy families share a certain core of common characteristics. Unhappy families each have something unique and diverse, some problem that makes them unhappy. And I think there's some room for debate as to whether that's an absolute statement. But I will go with the part this morning that every happy Christian home will be applying and growing in certain core principles. God didn't leave us to just blunder blindly through home life without guidance. His word outlines principles that support Christian home life. So the title of the message this morning is Seven Pillars of Godly Home Life. Tempted to do a little bit of sketching to illustrate my thoughts. The burden of the message is to renew our consciousness of scriptural principles for the Christian home and inspire us each to redouble our efforts to build our homes on this foundation. And I want to start by with a disclaimer. My wife and I are in the heat of home life. So I do not stand here this morning having achieved the perfect home life and telling you how to do it. I join you in this quest for godly home life and hope that we can be inspired together. And I also want to commend and affirm the good work that I see the Lord doing in your homes. I've been blessed to see the family life that is evident in your congregation. So I want to affirm and encourage that. I'd like to start the first part of the message, some foundational concepts. These are prerequisites or essentials or non-negotiables. They're part of the irreducible minimum of a godly home. And I've illustrated them with a few things on this drawing that I'll just point out to you. The first foundational concept is that God's eternal truth is the foundation, and Christ is the crowning head. And God must permeate every chink of the architecture in between. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. The second fundamental concept is that one man of God and one woman of God enter into an indissolvable threefold relationship with their Lord. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. And those of you who are in construction recognize that the triangle is the strongest geometric shape. That's why you see it in trusses, and that's why you brace across the corner of rectangles to create triangles. This threefold cord between a godly man, a godly woman, and Christ as their head is a very strong relationship. And so then, the third foundational concept is that children that are lent by God to this union enter the most secure environment on this earth. And that is part of what God intended for the home. They're within this threefold cord. They're within that very strong structure of husband, wife, and Christ. I love the verses in Isaiah 32, verses 17 and 18. "And the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. And my people shall dwell in a peaceful habitation and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. And I'm sure that applies, was primarily meant to apply to the kingdom of God, but I think our homes can be small versions of that. So God has set up these principles. He designed marriage, he designed the family, and he expects us to build on the foundation of his eternal truth and erect these seven pillars to support and strengthen our homes. So those are the foundational concepts. Now I'd like to look at the seven pillars of godly home life. And pillar number one is devotion. The word devotion simply means religious fervor, piety, an act of prayer or private worship, and that's when we often put a plural form and talk about devotions. It can also mean a religious exercise or practice other than regular corporate worship. And so I would submit to you this morning that religion, godliness, starts at home and continues in the church and is reinforced by the church. It's not something that we put on to come to church on Sunday morning. It must be in the fabric of our home. It must be one of the pillars of our home life. Devotion includes Bible reading and prayer. Acts tells us that Cornelius was a devout man, one that feared God with all his house and gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. One of the first things, and it's in some of the marriage vows that our bishops use. I haven't been to one of our weddings in recent memory that I could actually tell you whether our bishops use it or not. But some marriage vows, or the admonition that the bishop gives during the marriage ceremony, says establish at once your family altar. You ever heard that at a wedding? It's got to be the first pillar. Must establish a house of prayer, regular family devotions. And there are various ways that family devotions work for various families. It can be done in the morning, it can be done in the evening, it can be done through Bible stories, it can include singing, or however it works for your family, do it. Someone observed that many men who can make eloquent prayers that make the church walls vibrate are lacking in prayer at home. It's okay for our children to see mom and dad with their Bible, having their personal devotions or simply reading. And a challenge that I aim at myself and I share with you, do my children see me with my Bible in my hands as much as they see me with my phone in my hands? We must exercise what the songwriter called our vital breath, our native air. Prayer is the Christian's vital breath, the Christian's native air. So we breathe in prayer and we breathe out prayer. Prayer should be the go-to response for perplexities, for troubles, for joys. I have many memories in my growing up years of my mom or my dad praying with me about anything from a lost kitten to a thunderstorm. I have a very vivid memory of a very nasty thunderstorm, and my mother gathered us children in the living room, and we were praying, and the hail started to beat on the air conditioner shroud, and right in the middle of the prayer, I remember yelling, "It's coming in!" But those are the foundational memories that stick with me. More recently, after my wife's family experienced some medical emergencies, our daughters would stop and pray when they heard an ambulance go past. Pray for whoever was being affected. Pray with them in the course of discipline. Pray for each other. Spouse should hear spouse pray for each other. Parents should pray for children, and children should hear that. And one of the greatest blessings that I'm experiencing in my stage of home life is hearing my children pray for me. So prayer and Bible reading are part of devotion. God awareness is part of devotion. Notice, when you have a triangle, the nearer that husband and wife draw to Christ, what happens to the corners of the triangle? It pulls together. The nearer the husband and the wife draw to Christ, the nearer they draw to each other, and the more secure the children will be. The home must have an atmosphere of reverence for God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We should see him in nature. We should see him in history. We should see him in math. We should see him at every turn of every day, in every corner of our house. We should see him through every valley. We should see him on every bright mountain peak. I have vivid memories of my father waking me in the middle of the night, of course, with my permission and assent, but he would wake me in the middle of the night when there was a solar or a lunar eclipse, or when there was a meteor shower. He was the one that got me up. I wouldn't have been able to get up on my own at that age. Those are bonding moments in which father and son, with a united and focused gaze on God, had an awareness, a very acute awareness of God. If we as parents are excited about God, our family will catch it. The second pillar is commitment. Commitment, yes, to Jesus Christ as the supreme head of our home, but also a commitment to his truth. In Deuteronomy, God said, "In these words, this truth that I give you this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates." And so I would submit this morning that if we fail to teach our children the truth about the reason for life and the truth of their accountability to God, and our children drift out of our homes into the world without the anchor of those fundamental truths. Why am I here and who am I responsible to? That we have failed. Everything else we have given them is a failure. It doesn't matter if we've provided excellently for their physical needs. We may have given them every luxury that money could buy. We may have left them a massive inheritance. We may have put the family name in the history books. But if we have not communicated a commitment to biblical truth, we have failed. And in our homes, we must have the pillar that if the Bible says it, we do it. It's also a commitment to unity. The verse we read in Genesis 2, "Therefore shall a man leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife in such a close relationship that they're the same as a single unit. They're one flesh." And I believe that husbands and wives, new husbands and wives, find the Lord's infilling grace and blessing as they face their struggles and their problems and their unknowns together, and they formulate the plans for their homes and the goals and aims for their homes together. And over the years, I've seen a number of young couples who seem to still have this invisible apron string back to mom and dad that is so tight that they can hardly build a life of their own. A close relationship with mom and dad is very important, but there also needs to be a leaving so that there can be a cleaving. The unity of a couple, when parents are loyal to each other, they put a pillar in their home. Discipline children together in unity. Give or deny permission to children in unity. My girls have this thing where I get home from work and they'll say, "Dad, I need to ask you about this and this. Mom said I had to ask you." And I'll give my verdict and they'll say, "Yeah, that's what I figured." I cringe when I hear a husband who denigrates or criticizes his wife or children in public. In the world, it's sort of this blood sport where men think it's somehow smart to roll their eyes about how dumb their wives are. I would submit to you that that is undermining a crucial pillar of the Christian home. Yes, there's lighthearted banter. I'm not saying that we have to be Spartan and never joke with each other. But fundamental respect and fundamental love and fundamental deference to wife and children is very important. Stories told of Winston Churchill, who attended a banquet in London, and to generate conversation, I guess, as an icebreaker, the guests were each asked, "If you could not be who you are, who would you like to be?" And everyone was intrigued by who Churchill would say he wanted to be. Was it going to be Napoleon, or was it going to be... When it came Churchill's time, he was an elderly man by this point, and he rose to his feet and he said, If I could not be who I am, I would most like to be, and here he paused and took his wife's hand, I would most like to be Mrs. Churchill's second husband. Now, Winston was not advocating an unbiblical marriage in that statement, but what he was saying was, if I had it to do all over again, I'd pick her again. That is commitment. That is a marriage partner loyal to another marriage partner. Parents should be loyal to children, and children are loyal to parents. I remember a story I read a number of years ago of a beekeeper, and his son stopped by just after he had emptied the hives and had a 5-gallon bucket of just golden, sweet goodness. And the son noticed that in that bucket were 3 bees struggling to keep from drowning in the honey. And he said to his dad, "Dad, get the bees out." "Oh," the dad said, "they're beyond hope. There's no hope for them." "Well, at least give them a shot. Get them out." So the son kept after the dad until the dad took an empty yogurt container and scooped the bees out and set them off to the side. He said, "They're not going to live, but anyway, pacify you." The fascinating thing was that within a few minutes of him setting those bees aside, they were surrounded by fellow worker bees who proceeded to work and clean the sticky honey off of their fellow bees and coax them back from near drownedness. They refused to give up on them. They refused to abandon them, and all 3 bees eventually were cleaned off and flew back to do whatever bees do all day. That is a beautiful picture of home life. Parents do not give up on children. Children do not give up on parents. We're there for each other. And when one is struggling, he finds the support in the Christian home. Commitment also involves fidelity. Hebrews 13:4, a very familiar verse. "Marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge." And I believe that the moral standard of society is determined by their view of marriage and home life. And that's a scary concept when you look into the world, but it's a beautiful concept when you look into the Christian home. Because if we follow God's laws of marriage faithfully, the purity of parents is preserved, and also the purity of children is preserved. And I would challenge each of us to never let the devil deceive us into beginning to believe that disloyalty in thought or desire is any different at its core than disloyalty in action. Disloyalty in thought and desire is simply the seed of the same bitter fruit and will eventually bear fruit. Let's establish it in our minds that marriage is one man and one woman for life. They become an indissolvable unit in God's eyes. And when marriage is entered on in the name of God, recognizing His will in bringing the marriage partners together, we really don't need to think very complexly and get ourselves all twisted in knots trying to figure out exactly what Jesus meant in Mark 10 about marriage and divorce and save in the case of fornication. That account, the Pharisees came to Christ to try to get Him to contradict the Mosaic law so that they could have an occasion against Him. And Christ cut through all of the fluff. He cut through all of the static, and He took them back to creation principle, Genesis 2:24, and He said, "From the beginning it was not so, but in the beginning it was one man and one woman for life." It's a simple teaching. Settle it in your mind. Don't look for loopholes. Very clearly, Jesus taught in Mark 10 that to put a marriage asunder is to work against God. In God's mind, as I read the words of Christ, only one thing dissolves marriage, and that is death. In Romania, in bygone times, before a couple was granted a divorce, they had to live together for 2 weeks locked in what was called the makeup room in a fortified church. They were locked in that room for 2 weeks. It had one bed, one plate, one fork, one spoon, one knife, and one cup. During that lockdown, they were checked on daily and brought food, but they weren't allowed out. And the purpose was to give them time to reevaluate their relationship and communicate without distractions. And it's said that in the 300 years that that makeup room was in action, only 2 couples who spent time in the makeup room went through with their divorce. The rest decided it was better to set their differences aside and make up and renew their commitment to each other. And I would just say one golden rule that I've found in marriage is mend any disagreement, any tension before you go to bed that night. Just don't go to bed with anything standing between you. The third pillar is headship. I invite you to Ephesians chapter 5. Again, these are very familiar verses, but I think they are verses that we do well to remind ourselves of. And I'm going to start with talking to fathers. So under headship, fathers are responsible to provide spiritual leadership, verses 25 to 29 of Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify it and sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it might be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. And if you back up to verse 23, this is in the context of the wives, but it also tells us the role of the husband. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is head of the church. Any man who has pledged his hand and heart to a woman owes her his life. He owes her his affection. He owes her his brain. He owes her his hands. He owes her his ears. He owes her his money and his ability to make money. And these verses are a call to die to self. And the man who doesn't die to himself for his wife can never come close to loving her as Christ loved the church. These verses also teach us that the man has the greater responsibility to train and raise children. And shame on us, dads, if we neglect our family for work, and maybe our generation doesn't face the workaholic scenario. I believe we're sort of in a reaction to that. So I'll bring it up to our generation. If we think our fathers work too much at the expense of families, let's be careful that we don't neglect our families for the sake of play. If dad never grows up and never leaves his toys behind and he just gets bigger and better toys and more explosive toys, guess what? His boys won't grow up either. The husband, the father, is accountable to lead out, not as a lord, but as a servant. And I believe as a dad, I will answer to my Lord. I will hold accountability for my influence on my wife and children. So fathers provide spiritual leadership. Mothers provide spiritual submission. Verses 22 to 24. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be unto their own husbands in everything. It's said that a mother's work is never done. And sometimes we look at the verses in Genesis 2, and we say that God made a helpmeet for Adam. Well, there is no such thing as a helpmeet. There is a helper meet or suitable. And so the wife, the mother, is the helper suited to the man by God who made them both. And her prayerful willingness to fill her place in the home is vital in this headship order. Someone said the first home was made when a woman, cradling in her loving arms a baby, crooned a lullaby. It's said that Congress has advice and consent power over the president. They are to advise the president and give consent to what he does. I'm going to change it a little bit for wives. Wives and mothers have advice and submit relationship to their husbands. They don't have veto power, but they are to advise behind the scenes and then submit and help the program. Sometimes a passive husband, the fault of being too passive, can be aggravated or exploited by a strong-natured or unsubmissive wife. If the husband knows that he's going to catch it at home for making a certain decision, he will not be likely to make it, even if it's right. I've also heard over the years some wives that will say to their children in public, dad is sitting there quietly, and the mom will say, well, I think X, Y, and Z should be done, but your father will make the decision. Who made the decision? When mom says that, she has made the decision, and she's just waiting for dad to rubber stamp it so that she can consider herself in headship order, and it doesn't work. So fathers provide spiritual leadership, mothers provide spiritual submission, and children are spiritual disciples. The next chapter, Ephesians 6, verses 1 to 3, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. One of the worst starts for a child entering this world is to grow up being allowed to be a disobedient and rebellious child at home. And Jesus was the perfect example of children being spiritual disciples and following their parents. Remember the time that Christ was missing after they had been to Jerusalem? And they hunted high and low for him and were worried sick like parents are when children wander off in crowds. And when they found him, Mary sort of took him to task and said, don't you know that we've been worried about you? And Christ said, well, I had to be about my Father's business. You see, Christ, in spite of a higher knowledge and a higher calling, was still respectful to his mother. And the following verse tells us in Luke 2 that he went down with them to Nazareth and was subject unto them. And that literally means he observed their order. He observed their headship over him, even though he could have said, I'm following my eternal Father. You don't get it. The fourth pillar is nurture. I chose nurture for this point because I believe that nurture includes at least three things that we sometimes put as separate points, and I feel that they should be part of the same nurturing package. Parenting is an awesome responsibility. We have accountability for our influence and teaching of a life that will never end. So nurture itself means care for and encouragement. Care for and encourage the growth or development of. And my mind went to some of the trees that I've planted over the years. Plant a young tree. What do you do to encourage it, to nurture it? Well, you feed it and you water it and you mulch it and you put animal guards around it. But sometimes you also need to stake it and you need to pull it over toward that stake to correct a bent. And when the tree is young, that tree is very flexible. You can contort it fairly easily. But when it is older, it can be nearly impossible to correct the bent. And so the three things that I think are involved in nurture are love, communication, and discipline, and I think they have to go hand in glove. In a healthy home, a child's best friends are his parents, and the parents have that opportunity to influence the child right from the start and establish those habits, bend the tree the way it should be bent before the world can really come in and influence that child. And so home is the place a child learns to work, learns to sing, learns to pray, learns to study. Yes, he does his Sunday school lessons. He learns to deny himself. He learns to help others. He learns to give. And so under nurture, I have love as the first part of nurture. Above all of these things, put on charity or love, which is the bond of perfectness. And love is as much the actions that we take as the words we speak or the cards we send or the gifts we give. Love is the best defense against the enemy of our souls, because when love binds us together and love binds us to God, we are in a very strong position to ward off the enemy. It's said that love is like a crown. When worn by even a poor man, he will feel like a king on a throne. Love is companionable. It is self-sacrificing. And the commitment to love is a commitment in spite of how a person feels. If you go to a wedding, on that wedding day, the bride and groom glow. Their eyes sparkle. Their lips just can't help but smile. But it's not very long into marriage until they discover that the concept of happily ever after belongs only to fairy tales. And I don't say that because marriage isn't wonderful. But I just say that because marriage is a commitment and it's work. There are dark valleys. There are starry heights to marriage. It takes giving all you have and all you are. And so love is not first and foremost emotional. It's first and foremost commitment and secondarily emotional. It's not about being in love. It's about putting love on, as this verse in Colossians tells us. Put it on. Communication is the second part of nurture. I have a distinct memory of when my older daughter was about 3 or 4. I was walking out across the snowy backyard to do some chores, and I heard this little voice behind me crow, "I'm following you, Daddy." And I looked back to see her very carefully planting her little boots in my boot prints in the snow. You talk about a wake-up call. It's also, I've discovered, true that the comments that I make about other drivers don't sound nearly so macho or so intelligent when they are echoed from the back seat. You see, a child's learning process involves copying actions, repeating words, and mirroring thinking patterns. And so more is caught than taught. Children will not respect a parent who says or acts like, "Do as I say and not as I do." I remember hearing the story of during COVID of a dad who, the grandma was in the hospital and the dad went into the hospital and was just reaming the nurse out because she wouldn't allow him to do what he wanted to do. Is there any correlation between that and then his sons acting like they should be able to do what they wanted to do in the schoolroom? Another father I know of has never been able to kick his nicotine habit, and his children have no respect for him. So what do our children see us do if we get too much change back at the store? What do our children see us do if they're small for their age and we could probably sneak them into the buffet at a younger age level and a lower price point? You see, more is caught than taught. And none of us is perfect, and so they will also catch how we acknowledge and respond to our failures. That communicates as well. One pastor told the story of his father, who after a brief period of tension in the home, looked across the table at his mother and said, "I am so sorry that I spoke to you the way I did. I'm ashamed of myself." And that pastor said he was not a Christian at that point in his life. But after the meal, he went to his room and he knelt down and he prayed, "Oh God, I thank you for a father like that. Make me more like him." And so we are responsible to work with our children and to be with our children. We cannot relegate training to the babysitters or to a phone or to an entertainment and expect our children not to imbibe those words and those actions instead of ours. Deuteronomy says, "And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up." That means we have to spend time with our children. We have to walk with them, because precept must be upon precept. Precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. So daily conversations with our children should help them with their spiritual welfare. Discuss the deep things of life. Discuss the questions. Discuss the matters of value. I believe that home should be a safe space for children to express their struggles and innermost thoughts. And sometimes they can be a little raw. But I think it should be a safe space for them to express those thoughts and those struggles and those feelings. But then they should always be guided and pointed back to Philippians 4:8, to the standard of what is true, what is right, what is honest, what is lovely. I tell my children, "Well, now you know how it feels, so you make sure you don't act that way to other people. Even if everyone else is doing it, it doesn't make it right." And let's be careful not to allow our children to become victims. "Oh, you poor dear soul, how will you ever live this down?" A sizable part of communication involves listening. And even after children are old enough to be semi-independent of mom and dad, they still desire mom and dad's counsel and their company. I remember distinctly coming home from young people's events, singings, or evening services, or whatever. And if my parents were still up, I would go in and talk to them. And those are some very treasured memories. Communication does not involve criticism and irritability and inconsistency, but it's gratitude and it's appreciation and it's support and it's unconditional love. I read the story of a doctor who was struggled. He was not very engaged in his family. He would show up for meals. He would show up to pay allowances. He would give curt advice. One time he was in his study and his little son took the nerve to enter the sanctuary where he didn't really belong, wasn't very welcome. And he said, "Dad." And the doctor kept on doing what he was doing, opened a drawer, tossed him a piece of candy. And he said, "Dad." And Dad opened a drawer and threw him a pencil. And he said, "Dad." And the doctor was finally sick of it and he whirled around and he said, "What do you want? Why are you bothering me?" He said, "Dad, I just want to be with you." And I wonder how many children lose heart because Dad had a hard day and wanted to be alone. Malachi 4:6, the last verse of the Old Testament, I think captures the beauty of what Christ wants to do in our homes. "He shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers." The third part of nurture, and I didn't think about it when I put this together, but notice it's the center pillar. And maybe that's why it's my longest point. Discipline. What's the root word of discipline? Disciple. Discipline is not about punishing children because they did wrong. Not necessarily. It is about discipling them. And so it's never done in anger, always done in love. "I love you too much to let you get by with this." I remember my daughter talking about a friend that she had in years gone by who would tell them at school, "Mom never spanks me." And is it any wonder that that same girl, in later conversation, made comments like, "Stupid mom." You see, as we talked about on Wednesday night, God is 100% love and 100% justice. And when parents are 100% love, the children know we would die for them. We would throw ourselves in front of a car for them. And yet, they know that we are 100% disciplined. We are 100% that this is the line and you will not cross it. That's what brings them security. So did mom really love that girl that she didn't spank? Not according to Proverbs 13:24. "He that spareth his rod hateth his son, but he that loveth him chasteneth him betimes." So discipline is an opportunity for teaching. Tell your children the personal stories that made you understand that you must discipline them for the behavior that you're disciplining them for. Spend time with children discipling them in good manners and being loving and kind and helpful. Think about the contrast between what the scripture tells us about David and Adonijah. It says that Adonijah's father, David, had not displeased him at any time, saying, "Why hast thou done so?" Versus what the Bible tells us about Abraham, the friend of God, and it says that God's commentary on Abraham was, "I know him, for he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord." The fifth pillar is brotherhood. The Christian home can exist in a vacuum, but I don't believe it can do so long term. The brotherhood is very important. One part of brotherhood is church engagement. I believe we should support our local congregation as much as possible. Children will sense our priorities, and they will mirror them. I heard recently of a young man, about 15, he didn't even know that there was winter Bible school at his congregation that night. And I believe he's on a slippery path. The second part of brotherhood is accountability. Children are confused and disillusioned when parents appear right on Sunday but live as they please throughout the week. And don't be surprised when they apply that same standard of accountability to home rules. Be glad for the brotherhood's role in keeping you and your family on a safe course. The sixth pillar is vigilance. History tells the story of an ancient town that was destroyed because when the watchmen would call out, At first, they were hypersensitive, and they would call out anytime they saw something suspicious. Well, the people of the town began to resent them for the false alarms, and so the watchmen decided, well, we'll just be quiet. And not long after that, the enemy really did show up, and the city that could have been saved was destroyed, reduced to smoking ruins. And later, someone came along and erected a little memorial plaque, and the plaque read, "Here stood a town that was destroyed by silence." And the question that strikes me this morning is, will our family have that same sad epitaph? Here is a family that was destroyed by silence, by a dad who wasn't paying attention. Dads, the church cannot, and the church doesn't want to, regulate every aspect of life. There's not a rule book big enough to tell you how to do everything and how to direct your family in everything. Many battles are going to be won or lost in the homes. And so I would say, rise up, O dad of God, and be vigilant. Ezekiel tells us that if the watchman doesn't sound the alarm, the blood of the people killed were on the hands of the watchman. So sometimes we think that we're going to be the exception to the rule. We can do this and get by. And often we end up proving the rule. And so we must be vigilant against external enemies. I'll just pose some questions to you. Is it possible that we ban worldly music from our homes, but fail to instill an appetite for solid church music? You know what's going to fill the gap? Contemporary Christian music, which is a bridge back to worldly music. My music tastes and convictions were formulated as a very young man. And although I took the same journey that many young men take, I came back to those early influences. Another question, is it possible that our forefathers rejected the radio and the television, but we carry in our pockets a device that's much more powerful and is a hybrid of both radio and television and beyond? And I'm working my way through these questions the same as what you are, but I would say, be very vigilant. Can we dress out of standard because it is more convenient and comfortable and expect our children not to adopt that comfortable casual as their new minimum standard? We also have to guard against internal enemies. The Anabaptist culture will not protect our children from their own carnal nature and their own heart weakness. And so if we relax after we've boarded up our home against all external influences, and we fail to monitor our children's activities and influences among their friends, and we don't know where they are, we're setting them up like many unsupervised children that I've heard of who have wished later in life that their parents would have kept better tabs of them and their activities and kept them from a curiosity going rogue. Some activities just simply pose unacceptable risks, and God give us the courage to simply and quietly say no. And then there are a whole host of activities that are allowable and perfectly good. But let's take the mindset of, like Ronald Reagan said about the Russians, trust but verify. We trust our children, but we have a good enough idea of where they are and what they're up to make sure that their carnal nature isn't getting the best of them. Is it possible to vigorously defend Anabaptist practices without failing to instill conviction and obedience to the biblical practices, biblical principles of the scripture that are behind them? It's not enough to just say, here is what we do. We must also communicate, here is why we do what we do, or the practice will not last. Is it possible that we are slow to embrace higher education, but we don't develop our spiritual perception and our children's spiritual perception, and we leave them vulnerable to the alternate health practices and the influence of some of the East Asia religions that come in as science, falsely so-called? God calls his people peculiar. And that word peculiar doesn't mean strange or odd. It means owned, belonging to someone exclusively or especially. And so are our families secure in their exclusive ownership by God, even if that makes them peculiar in the world's eyes? Casual Christianity does not build strong or godly homes. And what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. The last pillar is the pillar of service. Some verses in Mark 6, verses 31 to 34, tell us something about Jesus and his outlook on service. Listen carefully. "And Jesus said unto them, Come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while, for there are many coming and going. There were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as to eat." These people were worn out. They had been serving, and they were worn out. And Jesus even said, "Come apart and rest." And we latch onto that, and we say, "I've got to say no, 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 because I'm worn out." But the story goes on. "And they departed into a desert place by ship privately. And the people saw them departing, and many knew him, and ran afoot thither out of the cities, and out went them, and came together unto him." They went around the lake, and when Jesus got there to have quiet time, there they were. And Jesus said, "I've reached my limit. Here are my boundaries. Thus far may you come and no further. Go back home." And Jesus, when he came out, saw much people and was moved with compassion toward them, because they were as sheep not having a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. And he ended up even feeding 4,000 of them from a couple loaves and fishes in that same account. Be very careful with the concept of boundaries, lest it turn selfish. "I've reached my limit. This is my boundary. Do not come any closer. Back off." I ask you, from those verses I read, how many boundaries did Christ place around himself to ensure me time? Hospitality is part of this pillar. Yes, balanced with family, but family can be built even as the family serves other people. Parents must have a commitment to serve their family. I believe there may be appropriate times to have a guy's trip or a girl's night out or a girl's weekend, but be very careful. You communicate something to your children. A minister from the 18th century told the story of two paddle boats that left Memphis, Tennessee on the Mississippi at the same time and headed downriver to New Orleans. And somewhere along that trip, as they steamed beside each other, folks on the one started to taunt folks on the other and challenge each other. And the next thing, a race was on. And the competition became very vicious as those two boats headed deeper into the south. And after a while, one of the boats started to fall behind because they started to run out of fuel. You see, they had plenty of coal for the normal trip, but they didn't have enough coal to run a race. Well, as that boat started to drop back, one of the crew got an idea. And he said, "Here's cargo that we're carrying. I bet that would burn." Sure enough, it did. And so they started to haul the cargo out of the hold and feed it into the furnaces, into the engines. They won the race, but they had burned their cargo and defeated the whole purpose of their trip. And I challenge us this morning, God has entrusted some very precious cargo into our homes. He's given us spouses, he's given us children, he's given us families. And our job is to do our part to make sure that that precious cargo reaches its ultimate destination in the world to come. And yet there are distractions, there are worldly goals, there are competitions that can very easily take priority. How many souls are we willing to sacrifice to achieve some worldly ambition? Socrates was a Greek philosopher, and somehow he managed to communicate a very biblical principle. He said, "If I would get to the highest place in Athens, I would lift up my voice to say, 'What mean ye, fellow citizens, that ye turn every stone to scrape wealth together and take so little care of your children, to whom ye must one day relinquish it all?'" God give us strength and wisdom to build our homes on the foundation of his eternal truth, and to secure the pillars of biblical principle that allow us to raise our families to his honor and glory. Let's kneel for prayer.